Hi everyone, welcome to this week's episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, where we were joined by a special guest, and that was Helen Scales. Now, if you don't know Helen, she is a marine biologist, a writer, a broadcaster. We've known her for many, many years. She's so funny, so interesting. She loves her subject so much. Her books are absolutely great. The first one that she wrote was called Spirals in Time. I think that was the first one, which was all about shells and the history of shells. And her most recent one is called What the Wild Sea Can Be. And it is basically a look at the future of the oceans, which you might think is quite negative because of all the news stories that are going around. But Helen, as is her wont, is very positive about what the future might be and how we can save the world. If you'd like to get her books, obviously they're available from all the usual places. But if you go to helenscales.com, you can visit her shop, which is related to the online bookseller's bookshop. And if you go there, then all her commissions will go to the charity Sea Changers, so you'll help save the sea as well as learning about the sea. There's also details on her website about a couple of shows she's doing to promote the book, so make sure you have a look at that if you like what you hear in this episode, and I know that you will. One more thing to say, you know we have a tour coming up. There is still tickets for most of the UK dates and a couple of the Australia dates left for that, so do get your tickets ASAP. And the people of Sydney and London, do go back to nosuchthingsafish.com/live because there are details of new dates on there. So if you missed out on tickets to Sydney or London, then fear not, because we have put some more dates on. Okay, that's it. That's all I have to say this week. So really, all there is left to say is on with the podcast. So let's say it. On with the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Anna Tashinsky and I'm sitting here with Andrew Hunter-Murray, James Harkin and extra special guest today, Helen Scales. And we have gathered around our microphones with our four favourite facts from the last 7 days. So, in no particular order, here we go. Starting with Helen.
My fact is you can play peekaboo with an octopus.
Wow. Cool. That sounds like fun.
I think it was peekaboo. That's what I was doing.
Because you've done this.
Yeah,
this is like,
yeah.
Personal fact.
Exactly.
So how did peekaboo work? Because the game is quite loose rules-wise.
I think so, yeah. I mean, maybe it was hide and seek. No, I think it was peekaboo. So basically, I was coming back from a free dive or a snorkel, if I want to make it sound not as cool. But I'll say free dive because that does sound cooler. And I was literally just a couple of feet from the beach and the water was like knee high. And I looked down, I was floating, and I looked down and there was an octopus behind a rock. And I was like, awesome, because I love octopuses. And I see them occasionally, but it's definitely a special thing to see.
Where were you in the world?
Oh, sorry. I was in Brittany, in France.
Very nice.
Yes. So there was this octopus, and I was like, awesome, okay, fantastic. And then generally, when I see exciting animals like that, you have to be like, just looking as much as possible, because any second now it's going to just fuck off, right? And you're left with like, oh, that was a lovely encounter, but it lasted like seconds. But this one didn't move and I was just hanging out with it.
And how big are we talking?
I mean, in my mind, it was like maybe a small melon sized, I think,
okay.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so first off, I did the My Octopus Teacher touching thing. Have you seen My Octopus Teacher?
No. That
documentary. There's a bit basically where if you put your hand out, an octopus will reach out and touch you with its
arms.
Oh, so
it's like God and Adam in the Michelangelo.
Exactly.
But God is an octopus.
Yeah, because I know they do that. They're tasting you to see what you are, because they're suckers. They're really sensitive and they can have you like taste the chemicals and stuff. So I put my hand out and it did. It's like put its little arm out and it's tiny and thin at the end and it was like, and it touched me and I was like, oh, that was amazing. And then so we did that and I was like, okay, so what else can I do with this octopus, you know, while it's got my...
Kick it up a notch,
So I was like, well, what if I just hide from it? Maybe it'll try and come and find me.
Wow.
And so I moved out of its line of sight so that it couldn't see me. And it was just, it just like peered around the rock. You know, it was definitely like, where have you gone? You're over there. And I'm like, no, you go. But I just really had this sense of something a bit more intelligent, and it's thinking about you and it's interacting with you. And it was just really a really cool moment.
It didn't then hide from you or anything like that?
No, it didn't hide from me. Then I think at that point I was like, I'm getting really cold. I need to get out. Can you do something a bit more interesting than just sit there? And so I think I was like, I'm going to get a bit closer. And at that point it was like, no. Okay. And it went off and changed. You know, you hear about how octopuses change colour and texture and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it really did. It had been like pale and smooth. And then instantly it turned like really angry red and very bumpy. And I was like, okay,
oh, wow.
Sorry.
Are the bumps real?
Yeah, yeah. So their skin...
It's not just that it looks bumpy.
Yeah, yeah. So their skin has like loads of little muscles, and they can pull up and make little like warts and little bumps, and then they can flatten themselves out.
Amazing.
And change the colour is also muscles too. They have these like bubbles of pigment which can open and close, and they can change their colour. It's like pixels, basically.
Wow. I never knew that's how they change their colour. Mm. I just sort of assumed that they... I didn't assume anything. I just thought they
did. You didn't really
it.
Think about yeah, it, yeah. did
no.
you? No, because he wouldn't really.
But just like the way that you blush, maybe they might just change colour.
They have layers in their skin.
We can't blush lots of colours. If only we could blush loads of different colours. Like I could blush blue if I
exactly.
was
exactly
on command.
That would be like a really cool thing to do with like GM, right? Just to like give ourselves chromatophores. Like that's what they're called. Octopuses.
That would be good. Be like it'd be easier for those. You know those parties where you have to go in a colour, like if you're available, you wear green.
Oh, your swingers party.
Yeah.
It's not always easy to find an amber shirt.
They definitely do seem to be animals where you can have a bit of a relationship.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to say I made friends with it, but I just felt like for a moment we had a bit of a play, and that was cool. I mean, yeah. I haven't ever played with a crab, for instance. That's never really worked out. Or a fish.
You've tried then.
Yeah, the crabs just don't go for the peekaboo. They really
well,
don't.
Well, sometimes, though, octopuses don't want to befriend. Like, they seem to have such personalities that they're discerning about who they like. There was a person who worked in a New England aquarium who... One of the octopuses there just completely took against him and used to squirt him in the room whenever he walked in, just absolutely hated him. And then I think he left and did a degree or something, left the university, and he came back and immediately the octopus was like, not Barry again, and went for him again.
Yeah, they are a bit moody like that. I've heard stories about octopuses being given food they don't like and just being like this, and they hold it up to the person and go like, uh-uh, see what I'm going to do with this? And they swim across to the other side of the tank and stuff it in the drain and be like, no!
Wow!
That's where that's going.
Like a toddler,
yeah,
basically.
I imagine there are those sorts of studies of like intelligence that are about that kind of level. Wow.
I reckon, although toddlers can't play hide and seek.
Can they not?
No.
Oh, because they just think you're not there when you close your eyes.
They did a study where they gave a toddler a doll and they put a blindfold on the doll and the toddler thought that they couldn't see it.
Wait, they thought that the doll couldn't see the toddler?
Yeah.
But the doll
and they
can't
thought,
see the
no,
toddler
no, they
way.
Thought that the toddler thought the doll had gone invisible.
The doll had gone invisible because
don't think that. Because I feel like I've heard that kind of thing, and obviously the study was done. But I've heard that kind of thing where like they think if you cover your eyes and you've gone, but when you do it with kids, they don't think you've disappeared.
I literally did it yesterday, and it worked.
Did you?
Yeah, yeah.
With your kid, what? So they just think, but they can see your body.
I said to her, I said, look at me. That took a while. Like she doesn't really do what I tell her. But then eventually she looked at me, and I covered my eyes, and I said, can you see me? And she said, no.
Does that mean that she thinks she can't see you, though, or that she thinks the thing to say in this game is no?
Well, just because...
It feels like if you vanished, then children would be like, what the hell
But the other
happened?
Evidence is that if you play hide and seek with a child, if they cover their eyes, they think you can't see them.
Like that's just in the middle of the room, eyes closed, I'm hiding.
That's great.
Yeah.
And the really interesting thing is it works for voices as well, apparently. Although I tried this with my daughter and it didn't work. But apparently there was a study where experimenters put their hands over their ears and said to the child, can you hear me? And the child said, no, I can't hear you. Now, I did try this and it didn't work with my daughter. I'm not sure if that means she's too smart or not smart enough.
But if you put on a different voice, will she think that, for example, Bruce Forsyth is in the room?
Like, and she's like, nice to see you.
I can't see you. Octopuses, I think, have they been reclassed in Britain in terms of their intelligence? Because they're so clever that the government has now classed them along with vertebrates. Like, they're way cleverer than lots of vertebrates. And they're classed as sentient beings.
That's right,
That's good news.
It is good news. It means, well, hopefully it means now we have to be nicer to them.
Because there are all sorts of discussions about, should we farm them? And it's like, should we farm these really intelligent, amazing, weird creatures?
that don't like living together and are generally cannibalistic and, you know, all sorts of stuff like that.
You don't want a farm like where all the cows are eating each other.
Well, exactly. You don't want just one great big octopus left at the end. I mean, that's no longer to be my
scene. Chop it up and just distribute it equally.
You might get the same number of steaks from one enormous cow that's eaten all the other cows.
And it's easier to herd, isn't it, if you just got one?
You need a big dog. Yeah. Very big dog. It's tragic. They can't write, but they do pretty zinc.
Oh, that is tragic.
Is that in the Alanis Morissette song?
Is it wasps or bees that can make paper?
Yeah, wasps can make
paper.
If they could get together.
Never the twain.
Give a wasp a snorkel and imagine what havoc the two species could wreak.
Was it Alanis Morissette? Ironic.
But they weren't very ironic.
No.
Most of the things
was the ironic thing.
Really not very ironic.
There was someone else, Avril Lavigne.
No, it was Skater Boy.
Yeah, I confused the two the other day in a social situation, and I haven't heard the end of it yet. Anyway.
He was a wasp. She was an octopus. Can I make it any more obvious?
They're very strong octopuses as well. Every sucker is so powerful, isn't it? And I think I worked out, so if a sucker touches an object, it like changes shape to form this seal around it. And I realised that the common octopus, if it's hanging off the ceiling, the four of us, and I've done some vague weight estimates, and I think it wouldn't be true if Dan was here, but I think the four of us
could. Dan is no heavier than I am, for sure.
But James, who does Dan have to be heavier than for this to work with the four of us, but not if Dan was here?
No, I do see that.
There you go.
But it did sound like a slam on Dan's weight.
It did.
Yeah. Look, I think we can safely say that Helen is a few inches shorter than Dan Schreiber. They're both in great shape, but Dan probably weighs a few pounds more.
Once I was in the ITV studios on the South Bank, and there was a load of people in the lift, and I walked into the lift, and it went, beep, 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 please leave the lift, because I was the person who put it over level. And I felt awful, like it was a really low moment in my life. But imagine that, if all your mates are hanging off an octopus, and you're the one that pulls him down.
And they're just like, nope, that's it, I'm letting go. Do you know what happens if you cut the arm off an octopus?
Ooh.
So this is, you know, if you wanted to eat it.
Does it live?
So, yeah. So fishermen will like chop the arms off and stick them in the bucket and they try to climb out basically. So octopus have like 500 million neurons, but half of them are in their arms. Mm-hmm. So they have a very different kind of nerve system to us. It's not all in their brain. So the question is like, do they think for themselves, these arms? Are they actually able to make their own decisions? But what we think they're doing is that their kind of response is to pass food towards the mouth. Mm-hmm. So if a bit of food goes to the end of the arm, the suckers are like passing it to the next one and to the next one. Huh. And actually that same motion, if you've chopped an arm off in a bucket, is climb out of the bucket. Do you see what I mean?
Right. They're just trying to pass.
They're just like, this is a thing we do. So it's not, there's not necessarily any thought in it, but they will basically walk off.
Oh,
The other thing, if you cut the very tip of an arm, it will still respond to like nasty chemicals. So people who are like doing science, and they'll take just a little bit of tissue off, mm-hmm. and then you try and put the little tip of the arm into a pot of alcohol, and it goes, oh no, ow.
Oh, ooh. Are we calling alcohol a nasty chemical?
Oh, sorry.
Well, I guess
very,
very
high concentrations of alcohol used to preserve the tip of an octopus's arm.
100% scientific stuff. Unfortunately for you, Helen, that's what Anna likes to do.
My limbs have cut off go towards the glass of tip alcohol.
Just a thumbs up from Anna's removed hand.
You don't eat octopuses, right?
No, I don't.
No. Do you eat other fish?
Not really anymore. I did for a long time. I gave up eating meat years and years ago, and then I kind of kept on eating sustainably caught fish.
But definitely octopuses, you wouldn't.
No, not since meeting one. I definitely not since playing peekaboo with one. I couldn't.
Something else that needs to avoid eating octopuses is the dolphin. although, I mean, they do like to sometimes. And octopuses are really good food for other sea animals because I guess they're very meaty. But they're quite dangerous to swallow. And I think when dolphins do eat octopuses, they have to really work hard on cutting up their food to tear them to shreds, because they did. I think they found a dead dolphin recently in the last couple of years, which had an octopus in its mouth, and you can see its tentacles like flopping out of its mouth.
So if I'm a dolphin and I have an octopus and it sort of clings onto the inside of my throat as it's going down because I haven't chewed it properly, does it pull me inside out? Is what I'm trying to say. I end up coming into work the next day saying, I think I had a dodgy octopus last night. Because it's attached to the inside of the tube that is me.
Yes, it has done
gone,
that.
And it's gone all the way through.
I don't think the dolphin was inside out okay. when they found it. I'm afraid that would be even more grotesque than the already the truth, which is, like you say, it suckers onto their esophagus until it chokes them to death, which is quite clever.
Okay. Yeah.
Could they be trained? I mean, the CIA are always training dolphins and things, aren't they?
Yeah.
Are you thinking, Andy, that we can defeat the CIA for whatever reason we might want to by sending an army of octopuses to turn their dolphins inside out?
Oh, yeah. That'll send a strong message, won't it? Britain is back on the global stage. We've inverted every dolphin the CIA has ever trained.
Okay, it's time for fact number two, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that during winter, the ground is too cold for male emperor penguins' feet, so they spend 2 months leaning back and balancing on their heels.
That's great.
That's so painful and uncomfortable.
They sound like kind of relaxed dads. You know, they're leaning back.
They've got their tail, like they prop back. Yeah, they lean back on the little sort of...
Yes.
It's like a hunting stick. I guess. Is that what it, you know, those things you can like...
Shooting stick.
More like one of those seats that an old lady sits on the beach.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm guessing you're very familiar with this and we should just say why they have to do this.
Because it's cold.
Because it's cold.
Really cold.
It's just really, really cold. It's freezing. They're in Antarctica. It's like minus 40 Celsius. And the female essentially lays her egg. I think this is right. And it's in the middle of winter because they need to start incubating the egg so that it's born in nice springtime when there's lots of food. So middle of winter, coldest possible time. The female's laid the egg, plopped it in front of the male, disappeared for a couple of months. And they have this incredible pouch that they plop over the egg. And the egg balances on his feet. But then if his feet are flat on the ground, then they just get super, super cold. And so, as you say, he leans back and like a tripod balances on his tail.
It's
for
amazing.
2 months.
I had vaguely seen that they did this. I had no idea about the details and how difficult it is. The dads can only eat snow for those months. Basically,
they get pretty skinny, don't they, by the end?
Do
they lose half their weight sometimes, or 40%? And the dads basically had an enormous mega barbecue the summer before. All the dads hang out. They put on lots and lots of weight because they know they're going to need it. They use it all up.
Oh, it's that's just interesting. Shrink, so when am I going to lose this weight that I put on after being a dad?
So, you need to head on down south and spend quite a bit of time on the sea ice.
They just lose no heat. Scientists did the sort of, you know, those heat map body things that you do, you know, you see where someone's losing heat. And I think they found that the only places they're losing heat are through their eyes.
Is really?
You know, in Dune, the film Dune, and the book Dune, they've got those still suits which allow them to lose zero moisture.
Yeah, they're really cool.
They're basically in the desert. Well, we're on the planet Arrakis. And
We get the idea.
Yeah. But they've got these suits, which means they lose no moisture. And the penguins, emperor penguins, are basically that bodily. They
That's
just
crazy.
Can do it and not lose heat.
Mm-hmm.
It's stunning.
Yeah, they get so hot. Like, you know, they do that huddling thing, the males, when there's a blizzard and they all cuddle together. Mm-hmm. They can be like so hot they have to break apart and be like, oh, God. And they're just steaming. Yeah.
It sounds more of a thing, which you wouldn't think, because you see them in documentaries and you feel so sorry for how cold they must be. But actually, it seems like overheating is more of a problem.
Potentially more of a problem,
And I always thought that those big huddles where, you know, hundreds of them, as you say, clump together, don't they, and they rotate who's on the inside. Yeah. I always thought they lasted for ages. That was kind of how they stood. But apparently it's about 50 minutes each one lasts.
So. And it's really when it's like, when a blizzard blows through and it's really cold.
Do you think they don't feel cold then?
I think they would if they got cold. Hmm. It just sounds like that they don't.
The threshold is just way lower than humans. So it's I think it's down to minus 10 Celsius. They're basically comfortable.
Well, that's the same as someone from Newcastle, I think.
That's why the black and white is the end of it. They're still a bit chilly then, I guess. If minus 10, they're comfortable. Minus 40, they're probably like...
That's when they're like, let's all, together a bit.
Do they have human conceptions of discomfort in the way that we do? You know, I don't know.
Well, that comes back to the whole sentient thing, you know. Mm. That's like kind of the big thing of that. It's like, are they suffering?
Is the first penguin dad to suggest a huddle looked on as a bit of a wuss?
Yeah.
Or is everyone secretly hoping someone's going to suggest it, but no one wants to be the first one?
Oh, I'm not going to hug you. Touch me, mate.
One thing I like about the whole penguin feather thing is, have you seen kind of on Blue Planet or whatever it was, of the emperor penguins whooshing up underwater and jumping out of leaps, right? They basically, that's like, need to get out of the water because there's probably something coming to eat me, but my little legs aren't going to be very good at clambering off mm-hmm. onto the ice. Oh. So they swim up from deep down, and it's skin that's their feathers. So basically, as they go down, they hold their contour feathers, the outside ones, in place. They lock them in place so that the air is trapped. And then as they're coming up, they basically let that air out, and it all comes fizzing out of the little under fuzzy bits.
Oh, cool.
And forms a stream of bubbles, and it's called air lubrication, and it basically reduces the friction against the water. And so they go a bit faster, and they go popping out of the water at the top,
and then
they land on the ice, and they've got a nice little tummy. Their fronts are covered with more feathers, so when they land, it's a nice cushion.
That's so cool.
Isn't that really
like
cool?
Iron Man. They've just got tricks for days. Yeah. They're a real risk of climate change, aren't they?
Yeah, because, sadly. You know,
they live on sea ice, and if sea ice melts.
That's this bit with the males and the chick rearing is on the sea ice.
And it's all on the outside, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Because they need access to the sea. If the ice melts, basically, then that means they, like lots of colonies, have had complete breeding failures where no chicks survive to the next year.
Happened 2 years in a row now. It's really bad.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the idea is that if the world keeps to 1.5 degrees of warming, then the numbers will hold up much, much better. If it goes far beyond that, you know. So that, like,
yeah,
that is
no,
the thing
it definitely to... matters. Like every degree we can like avoid of heating, like the better the emperor penguins will do. Yeah. And you know, like the cool thing I love about it as well is how we study numbers of penguins is from satellites. There's like once a week a satellite passes over Antarctica and takes photos, and you can only do that during the summer because it's dark during the winter, obviously, and you can't see anything. But in the summer months, they pass over and take photos, and then you can count the penguins and their poo, basically. The guano stains the ice and you can see where they are. So that's how you figure out how many there are. And so basically, the end of the winter, when the sun comes up again, it's like, fingers crossed, everybody. How many are still there?
You're looking for a huge poo on the ice.
When we see. So basically, this year, we won't know till, because it's just going dark now.
Right.
We won't know till like September, October, how year's clutch of penguins has done.
I wonder, do they take into account the level of poo? By which I mean, like, let's say your penguins are not eating very well for whatever reason, they might poo less. And I wonder if when they look at it, they can.
To be honest, I don't know whether they do the poo for individual numbers or whether they're just like, here's a colony.
I see.
That's generally there. And then you zoom in and you can actually see like a little shadow. That's how good the satellites are. You can see, and they're so tall that you can see a penguin's shadow in the satellite images and therefore count each individual.
Yeah, and actually, I think one really interesting thing is you can tell how many individuals there are in one of these huddles by knowing the size of the huddle and the temperature outside.
Oh,
because they're really mathematically precise.
That's
really into like hexagons. You know how hexagons are the best way of packing things?
Right.
If you kind of take a big pile of penguins, you know how much they're huddling because you know how cold it is, and you just put a load of hexagons on that grid, that's how many penguins there are.
Oh, what you mean if it's colder, they'll go closer, they'll suddenly be 10 to a meter instead of...
I don't know whether to be more impressed by scientists or penguins than that, as if working that out is unbelievable. Them working it out as penguins is unbelievable. I'm just very impressed by everyone.
They're really cool.
Yeah.
I didn't know that part of Scott's expedition was about penguin eggs, collecting penguin eggs.
So crazy.
Scott of the Antarctic.
That one. So 1910 to 1913, his Terra Nova expedition. A lesser known part of it, in I think 1911, was where three of them, I think it was sort of the brainchild or the person who was most passionate about it was Edward Wilson, who was Scott's second in command. And then there was this other chap called Apsley Cherry Garrard. But they were there to go and collect emperor penguin eggs, weren't they? Because they believed it was going to be really evolutionarily important.
That's right.
They
thought they were the oldest birds, and that there was this theory of recapitulation, which totally fell out of favour, but the idea that an embryo retraces its evolutionary heritage of its ancestors. So it would kind of basically start off in its egg as a little reptile and then turn into a bird as it was growing. And so it kind of totally comes back to this whole like crazy winters and the males with the eggs on their feet, because the only way to get an egg with an embryo in it is to go in the middle of winter.
Absolutely.
Pick them up.
The hardest possible. And not only is it freezing cold, of course, pitch dark.
Kept falling down like holes in the ice. Yes. It was ridiculous.
But then surely you've also got to fight an angry dad.
It's not in his fighting weight, though, is it, at that stage?
Exactly. So the three of them went, and then the three survived. But Cherry Garrard got back, and he was so ill from this expedition that he didn't go on the bit to the South Pole, which is where Bowers and Wilson died with Scott.
Right.
But they did get the penguin eggs. But, I mean, it sounds extraordinary. So Cherry's teeth chattered so violently with the cold that they shattered, apparently.
Do you know how they kept warm as well?
How?
by burning penguins.
That's dark.
Oh, guys.
That's very dark.
Hey, you do what you can.
I thought you were going to say they had a lovely hug and a cuddle together. And that,
well, I'm not hugging you. I'm going to burn this penguin.
I mean, that was when they went to the colony. They grabbed a whole bunch of eggs and they took some adult males.
I know, like, skua...
And they burnt them because they're really oily. So.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, skuas, they burn quite well, don't they? Like,
oh, do they?
They use those as lamps. They stick a wick up there. But yeah.
I mean, how strong are your ethical principles when you are near the South Pole and suddenly you realise it's death or penguin burning?
It was a couple of penguins. It's only a couple.
And it was, so it took him 45 minutes each night to chip into his frozen sleeping bag.
Oh, no. They probably burnt like the novels that they brought with them and the finish before they burnt the penguins.
Yeah, I imagine
probably.
So, yeah.
I mean, not the Dickens, because you need to keep hold of the best ones.
Sorry, it took 45 minutes to chip into his sleeping bag.
Each night it would be
each
a block
night.
Of ice and he said 45 minutes.
And all I've got is one of these pieces of my own tooth to chip away with.
Oh, my God.
That sounds... Yeah. Well, I'm going to bed. You're going to bed early. Yeah.
Got the old sleeping bag chipping to do. And there was also a thing where they had three sleds, I think, but they could only pull one at a time. So for every sort of mile they travelled, they had to do three back and forth.
Oh, no, God. And they couldn't leave the chicken on the sled at the same time as the grain.
So we've got a penguin, an octopus and a dolphin.
Okay, it is time for fact number three, and that is Andy.
My fact is that when Queen Elizabeth II got married, the people of Leamington Spa clubbed together and bought her a washing machine.
Aww.
Yeah.
That's nice.
It's very nice.
Clubbed together? How expensive was the washing machine, or how little did each individual in Leamington Spa contribute?
Wow.
Wow.
Well, I'm sorry, but that's less than one penny each, isn't it? Once you've taken everyone.
I'm sure they were more expensive in 1947, I guess.
Yeah.
It was also a time famously of massive deprivation.
Sure.
After the war.
Yeah.
Like bread was rationed at this point.
They all used their ration cards to buy her a washing machine.
Did she have one already?
Unclear. I think out of diplomacy, she was a famously diplomatic woman. She would never have said, actually have 16 washing machines in my different houses everywhere. So she was Princess Elizabeth at the time because she wasn't yet queen. That's how it works. And 1947, post-war, really poor time. So lots of gifts were food, you know. I mean, people, and you know, gifts from around the world. She got given... lots of dresses, most of which she gave away to other girls getting married around her age around the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, so
that's cool.
Yeah. The list of wedding presents, this is so weird, was published as a book and you can buy it today. And I have ordered it and it hasn't been delivered yet.
So
tune in next week when I'll be doing the same fact again. Yeah. But it's like there were just weird presents, like 500 cases of tinned pineapple.
Can you get through that much pineapple in your life?
I don't think I could.
No, that's the governor of Queensland sent that.
I haven't had one tin this year.
Haven't you?
No.
Gosh.
Maybe after this.
I think I had my first tin pineapple of the year yesterday.
That is a coincidence.
Isn't it? That bizarre. Yes, it was part of a Penang curry.
Ooh, lovely.
People sent her stockings, which I find quite a personal thing to send someone. And she got over 100 pairs, I think, hundreds of pairs of nylon stockings, which were a high-value item. Nylon was a newly invented thing.
Yeah.
And
what would the equivalent be to that? Bitcoin, probably.
The people of Leamington Spa chipped together to get you one Dogecoin. Royal wedding gifts are often quite weird, aren't they?
Yeah.
Grace Kelly, friend of the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
She got a yacht.
That's a nice gift.
Oh, Aristotle Onassis.
Yes, please.
Yeah, which village clubbed together to buy
it? Yeah, that's better than washing machine, isn't it?
The interesting thing about that is it was a repurposed ship. It was a yacht. And then it got turned into a ship for the war and was used at Dunkirk to help evacuate soldiers. Oh. And then after the war, Onassis bought it again and turned it back into a yacht and then gave it to Grace Kelly as a wedding gift.
That's sort of recycling, sort of.
Sorry, which bin does this yacht go in?
Oh, that's great. That's much better than the one I felt. Prince Charles and Diana, when they got married, a council in Somerset sent one ton of peat.
Oh.
Because he's a farmer and, you know, he uses it. Well, he's not a farmer, is he? But he owns lots of farmers.
Yeah, but you know, that was a huge faux pas, really.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he was too, like... sending excrement to a wedding. Is that a faux pas?
Oh, Pete's isn't excrement.
No.
I need to do some basic lessons.
But it is.
Okay.
It was Sedgemoor District Council. They sent him a ton of peat. And this was exactly about the time that Charles was banning peat because he is very environmentally aware and has been for a very long time. And in the 80s, he banned peat use on all of his farms because, you know, it's a big... biodiversity area.
Now compost,
it's huge.
All of that.
Also, it like sequesters a lot of carbon, doesn't it?
Although I don't think he knew that at the time, but he was very, you know, he predicted. So Sedgemoor, you screwed up.
Oops.
And that's...
One nice wedding gift I found is something that people get in Japan called the Venus Flower Basket.
Oh, yes.
Do you know it?
I know this one, yeah.
Go on, tell us what it is.
So it's a deep sea sponge. It's a glass sponge, so they're made out of kind of silica, basically. They look like a very ornate stocking, so a bit sort of like a woven, knitted stocking. Mm. And then there are these shrimp that live inside them, and they get inside them when they're larvae, so they can sort of go through the holes of this glassy sponge thing. And then they get trapped. And so basically you have a male and a female that are trapped inside this sponge and can't get out.
And that's like a marriage.
Exactly. And they send their babies off into the world through the holes of their sponge, but they stay their entire life inside the sponge.
Yeah, it is that. It's because like the male and the female stay together the rest of their lives, isn't it?
Oh, it's a claustrophobic concept of marriage, isn't it?
Lovely.
What I also found is like, because it's like this glass sponge is like in a framework, isn't it? It's like a lattice.
Yes.
And they found that the currents go into it and they create like a little vortex. And it means that when the male and the female release their sperm and eggs, it's the perfect vortex to make them all sort of mix together.
Ah, cool.
So that's quite romantic as well, isn't it?
It is. It's lovely. I've heard as well that they designed the gherkin in London around the skyscraper, around the sort of shape of a sponge as well. And it was like, rather than water and other things circulating around it, it's like it's for air conditioning and it pulls air in and it goes up the building.
Do not release sperm around the gherkin if you're looking for love.
Just see what happens. Just see
what happens. Building security and the cleaning team will both be dispatched.
That's so interesting.
Wow, that's very cool.
Yeah.
We do a washing machine thing or two?
Washing machines.
They're bad.
Are they?
Yeah, washing machines are bad. Synthetic cloth washing accounts for 35% of primary microplastics found in the environment.
Wow, that's high.
And they're trying to come up with a law where all new washing machines have to have a filter in them. And it's already the law in France, I think, but at the moment it's not the law in the UK, and it needs to be the law in the UK.
Oh. And does that stop the microplastics getting out and into the water system?
Yeah, that's a filter, yeah.
And when you say synthetic fabrics,
T-shirt you're wearing, it's cotton, I guess.
I think it is.
I think you're talking more like fleeces and...
Yeah, like polyester.
Polyester.
Fleeces are particularly bad because they just shed loads of fibres.
Why would you ever wash a fleece?
Yeah, good point.
Mm.
Next time, don't.
I'm the school of like, if it's an outer layer, you never wash it.
No.
Yeah. Unless you fall in a swamp.
Oh, and if you're wearing your fleece, you might be...
What if a bird poos on you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just wipe it.
Wait till it's dry and then a stiff hog's back bristle brush.
Yeah, obviously.
Do you know that the first fleeces were called synthetic chinchillas?
No, stop it.
Yeah, I think that's right.
When was that?
When?
Yeah, roughly.
20th century.
Get away.
20th century, yeah.
Because before that, people were wearing chinchilla.
Real ones.
I think chinchilla was a name of a fabric that was kind of similar to what a chinchilla was, but it was like, it was made of cotton, but it was called chinchilla.
That's so
and then
funny.
This was synthetic chinchilla.
Chinchilla.
I think
that's
right.
Amazing.
Ironic, because actually they're sort of chin warmers, aren't they?
That's very right, yeah.
Gosh.
Good grief.
Can I tell you a washing machine fact?
Yeah.
Sure.
This is good. So, you know the Samsung jingle?
The Samsung jingle? No.
That's not one of the famous ones.
When your washing machine finishes, it plays a little tune.
And if Samsung?
The Samsung, yeah.
No, I don't know it.
There's a tune, well, lots of
my washing
machines.
Machine just goes beep, beep, beep when it's finished.
Oh, does it go doom, 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 or something like that?
Nope.
that's an announcement on the underground, you're thinking
Yes. I installed the wrong thing in my kitchen.
It's the one that goes dum 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 dum.
Really?
And it's really long, right? So this is so mad. It was composed in 1817, the Samsung washing machine jingle.
For this? With this in mind?
It's Franz Schubert.
Wow.
I know. And it's a song. It's called The Trout. So there's an aquatic theme.
Oh, okay.
And it's based on a poem, a different, confusingly, a German writer called Schubart. And it's about a trout that gets caught by a fisherman. And it's a warning to young women to stay away from men.
Well, there you are.
Yeah. Yes. And this is the tune that is in every Samsung washing machine. It's a little sort of ceremonial ditty that plays at the end of... And I have one of those washing machines. I hear that tune a couple of times a week.
And your wife leaves the house. What a multi-layered fact. Yeah. There are so many bits to grasp.
Well,
there.
I mean, to start off with, I didn't know Samsung made washing machines. I thought they made TVs.
Right. That's the foothills of this fact.
Yeah. Yeah.
Schubert and Schubart. I want to know about that comedy double act. Can I ask you guys a question about your washing machines?
Yeah.
How much washing powder do you tend to put in?
I just put one of those, like, you know, those Tide Pod things that Americans eat. One of those.
Oh, you do the Tide Pods.
Just a scoop. I don't use powder, I use liquid.
Nice.
From a refill shop.
Well
very
done.
On message. Just a cup of that. A lid.
Good, but I'm afraid it's not quite as good as the old reusable egg full of dry granules that I use. Oh. I've got one of those.
You do have to fly down to the Antarctic to get the egg, don't you?
That's why I've lost all these teeth, these front teeth of mine.
Is that right? You wash with a reusable egg?
There's a little plastic egg, which is full of dry granules, and they last about like 100 washes or something.
That's
and you just replace those dry granules.
I wondered why you smelt so bad.
Like it works. It's really
good.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a much better public service announcement than mine, which is if you're just using normal washing powder, you should never need to use more than really a tablespoon. Which is much, much less than you're probably using.
Yeah.
This was a New York Times expose. And it's really bad to overuse it because it makes your clothes go all crunchy.
Can I ask, Anna, as someone who has a toddler who's currently potty training, and so I often have urine and feces stains on my clothing, is it different for me?
It says for extremely heavy loads, you might want 2 tablespoons, but you're never going to need more than that.
Okay. Thank you.
And they're lying to you, the companies, with their cups on the lids, because
exactly.
They just want
they
to get through it.
They give you a little scoop, don't they?
Huh. Yeah. Oh, it's in their interest.
Yeah.
Big,
there you go.
Course. Big
wide
powder.
Open. But, because I've always thought the whole thing's a scam, and what I've always thought is the whole, all the washing clothes thing, it's a scam. The thing I've always thought is the drawer thing, got to be a scam. So I've always put everything in the drum.
Yeah, I do that as well.
Well, what I've realised, if you use fabric softener, if you put that in the drum, which I always have done, it's completely pointless.
Oh, really?
And it's because it's to do with the charging of it. So fabric softener is partly there to stop your static clothes sticking together. And it does that by being positively charged so that the negatively charged clothes sort of bind with it and become neutral. There you go. That's kind of what it does. But it has the opposite charge to your washing powder. So if you put them in at the same time in the drum, they cancel each other out and it doesn't do any good.
Huh.
So if you are like me and you're just tipping your fabric softener in the drum,
don't do that.
Stop it.
Right.
And stop using all of it and be more ethical like these guys.
Get the egg. Get the plastic. I swear, get the egg and the granules.
Get the giant penguin egg. Yeah. Shove it in the washing machine.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Can I just tell you one wedding present thing? So it's based on a fact I discovered, which is that in 2015, Cristiano Ronaldo bought his agent, George Mendes, and his wife, Sandra, a Greek island as a present. So they're best friends. I think he was best man at his wedding or vice versa. So they're very close. How sweet. Bought him a Greek island. And I was just like, how do you buy someone a Greek island? And do you know there's a website called privateislandsonline.com which just has loads of islands for sale?
Yeah.
And this, when Greece went through the credit crunch, I didn't realise, but lots of economists advised, and eventually they went with it, advised that they put up a bunch of their islands for sale to make back some of the money.
I have been on this website, I think.
Have you got an island?
No, I think, like, if memory serves, you go on and it's like some of them are like not beyond the realms of possibility of someone like
exactly.
me could buy. But it's always like a tiny island in a loch in the northernmost part of Scotland. And it says no electricity, no water, no ability to get to the island.
Well, you know, you'd be living a little bit off grid. Yes, but I still think the cheapest Greek one I found was $5 million. So if you know,
if we all club together,
if those bastards in Leamington Spa actually chipped in, and dug deep,
maybe I don't know what the mortgage offers are on this. It's Strogilo Island or Strogilo Island. It's got beaches around the edge.
Okay, hear me out.
Yeah.
No such thing as a fish island. Everyone who's listening,
yeah,
chips in a bit,
go
and
on.
Everyone gets to go there.
Okay, lovely. I love it. Let's do it. We can get $5 million. It's 54 acres, so we could all fit.
Is there anything on it?
Some trees. It's very green. It's very verdant.
Sounds lovely.
Oh, and it's got power in some way. I mean, there's
a power station. There is a nuclear power station in the middle, and it had a little hiccup a few years ago, but honestly, it's fine.
It's fine. Anyway, just something to bear in mind, wow. I think.
Yeah, get that Kickstarter going.
Yeah, I think I will.
Get Anna on Ireland. Lovely.
Could I do animal gifts?
Oh, yeah.
Wedding gifts. Can we do this quickly? Technically known as nuptial gifts, and there are lots of animals that give each other a present before mating. Did you know about this? It's usually the males, but occasionally it's females that offer something. It's usually food, but the really cool one I found was the nursery web spider. So the males approach the female and give her a gift of usually an insect, and he wraps them up in silk. And the females prefer the wrapped ones. They like the white, shiny, wrapped up presents.
Yeah.
But he'll give her the present and she will open it and start eating it. And meanwhile, he's getting busy with what he needs to do. So they start mating while she's opening her present.
Right there. Yep, okay.
And
just,
generally...
Can you just wait?
No. It's sort of the whole point. And if she can...
At least sing happy birthday.
He's mating while she's
opening the present. Gosh. But basically, because it's wrapped up, he can cheat and they don't always put something inside.
No way.
That's so funny. Yeah. It's like deal or no deal.
So that's what So basically some of them are like, well, I'll just put this old piece of shit in here. Like, no one's going to know until she's opened it, because it takes a bit of time. And if she opens and she's like, what is the... Okay, and then basically...
Too late, I've done it now.
So then she'll be like, no, off you get, we're going now. But the male, they also do a thing where... So Hickton, this is from the paper, actually. There's a study of this. And I just thought this is a lovely sentence. Mm. However, if the female moves and attempts to terminate copulation, the male may perform thanatosis, which is death feigning behaviour. He stretches out his legs, which is unique to this species. The male then ends the insertion and grasps the gift with his chelicerae, which are his like mouth parts. And then the female moves away while holding on to the gift, and the male is dragged along behind the female until eventually she'll give up, and then he revives and resumes mating.
Wait, so, okay, I was going to ask what his end game is here, because I thought he was just trying to get the present back.
Yeah, me too, to re-gift it.
Well, I don't think we really know. I mean, his end game is to basically try and make them as long as possible, because the longer they go, the more chance they have of fertilising. And so basically giving her a crap present is not a great idea, because she will be like, no, I'm going to stop now because there's nothing in here. Mm-hmm. And the better the present you get, the more time. But it seems that sometimes they just don't have anything, or they're really hungry and they eat the gift first. So they take the insect, they eat it.
Honestly, I did buy you a bottle of wine, but it was a long train journey.
Anyway, here's the bottle.
Anna, stop mating with me.
And you've never invited me back.
Anna feigning death, clutching the wine bottle in her mouth.
Okay, it's time for our final fact, and that is James.
Okay, my fact this week is that hermit crabs are facing a housing crisis.
Join the club.
Oh, satire bell, everyone. Ding, ding, ding.
What do you mean?
I think it's relatively self-explanatory in that hermit crabs, as you might know, don't have their own shell, so they go and find a new shell, and usually it's one that's discarded. But it turns out that there aren't as many shells as there used to be. There's various different reasons. One reason is because gastropods, shell creatures, are shrinking. The populations are shrinking. But the papers basically analysed photographs of crabs online. And
social media pictures of hermit crabs.
They basically went onto Instagram and looked for hermit crabs and found loads of pictures of them using bottle caps, soda cans, Lego bricks.
The really scary bit is it's the broken end of a light bulb. So they're like the metal bit that you screw in.
Yeah.
They use that.
Yeah.
Wow. There's quite a few pictures of hermit crabs You know,
and I guess those are very durable in the ocean, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
And they just last a long time, don't they?
And I think that's one of the other reasons they're doing it, just because it's what's there.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was another study in 2019 that found that 500,000 hermit crabs are dying every year after getting stuck inside bottles and things like that.
No way. It's
bad news for hermit crabs.
It is. I mean, it's kind of mad. Apparently, as well, this plastic starts to smell like dead crabs, and that's one reason why they come towards them. So there's a stuff called dimethyl sulfide, which is this molecule that does all sorts of important things, like make clouds, and it comes off plankton in the ocean. But it also, it's like, it's the smell of a rotting crab. And that, but it sticks to the outside of plastic stuff, plastic pollution in the ocean. So one reason possibly why these crabs are going for the Coke bottle lids and yogurt pots is because they think it smells like a dead crab, and therefore it's a shell that's just been left behind by another crab.
Because you would use that naturally.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. These hermit crabs will use whatever they can find. Mm. So in Madagascar, there was a beach where there's a big cliff full of fossil shells, so really old shells, and the crabs will wait at the bottom of the cliff waiting for the fossils to drop out, and then they will use those as their
home.
That's
so cool. That's so like buying like a period property, like a listed building.
They're not allowed to decorate those.
Yeah, no.
That's amazing.
So they will use all sorts of things.
It's really interesting what you said about how they'll go towards the smell of a dead crab, because obviously in nature that's very unusual, isn't it? Like usually if a member of your species has died, you would usually give that a bit of a wide berth.
Yeah, unless you want to eat it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, which is what they do, I think, as well, right?
They might do. But yeah, you're right. It's not a good smell. Like carrion, rotting carrion is not.
Yeah. So what happens is that sometimes they'll climb into a bottle, and because the bottle's smooth, they can't get out. So they'll die. And then the smell of the dead crab comes out. And then the next crab goes, oh, great. Dead crab goes into the bottle, and then they get stuck.
Oh, no, it's like a horror film, and then the next crab goes to find that
exactly.
dead crab.
And then you've got a bottle full of dead crabs. Oh, God. Yeah. And another kind of crazy thing about this is that maybe it's actually kind of makes sense from the crab's point of view, because if there's a ton of plastic around and you want to hide, then you hide inside the plastic. And then and then predators might also not really have figured out that there might be crabs inside of yogurt pots. And so they haven't kind of learned yet to go looking. So it could be actually an advantage for the crabs. And they're also lighter.
Yeah.
As a shell.
Petit filou. They take almost no energy to pick up.
They are really clever, the sort of the way they do it. So they sometimes evict each other. So if you have outgrown your shell and you spot a hermit crab with a shell that would be perfect for your current size, they go over and bang on the shell with their claws.
They do. And before the fight breaks out, they'll show each other their claws, because if you've got the bigger claws, then generally you're the one who wins. So they try not to have a fight.
Oh, okay.
They'll be like, look, I'm this big, and the other one they'll compare claw size. And that can deflect fights.
That would be good. Yeah. You know, in boxing at the start, before the boxing fight, they always come up to each other and sort of like stand head to head and sort of talk to each other. It'd be good if every time one of them just went, oh, no, I'm going to lose this.
Oh, yeah.
You're way bigger than me.
Is that the weigh-in, James?
Yeah, yeah.
Are they actually weighed at that point?
Yes, they are. Because in most weights, there's a maximum weight you can be. And they try and get as close to that as possible.
And are they both, I've always wondered this about boxing, are they both standing on the same set of scales? Because they're standing right facing each other and looking at each other. I always wonder if there's one big set of scales in the middle that they both have to get on.
As in, like, one of those balance scales that goes up and down.
Yeah.
No, it's one set of scales and they take turns.
Oh, they do. Okay.
Yeah. You've got to use the same set.
Oh, sure. Yeah. But it would be nice if there was a joint set and they could both use it at the same time. And if it goes over the weight.
Just a seesaw.
Exactly.
And it has to be exactly balanced.
Yeah.
And it would be nicer if in the middle of the boxing ring was a seesaw. And whoever wins the seesaw.
How do you win at seesaw?
I was a very competitive child. Absolutely crushed them on the little springy dogs at the park today. Hermit crabs.
They do actually decorate their homes quite well. And we've talked about the way they move house, but when they're living in their house, they do various things. The anemone hermit crab gets anemones and sticks them to its shell. And I think it's because they've got stinging tentacles that affect other passers-by. And so it's a little bit of protection. The anemone gets some food. But when they move shells, they do then take all the furniture with them. The flat doesn't come furnished. And so I think they spend ages... Is this right? They spend ages prizing off the anemones.
Yeah, yeah. There's a species of deep-sea anemone that was discovered just last year, and they got a couple into the aquarium, and this was scientists in Japan. And it spent 2 days trying to move the anemone.
Wow.
Yeah, it was like pinching it and pulling it and like just generally trying to get it to let go. And then you've got to persuade it to cling on to the new one as
Oh my God.
It just doesn't want to move?
Yeah, the anemone, I don't know if it knows. It's basically just, I don't know. But it's just not cooperating.
It just clings on, right?
It just clings on. Okay. But the crab is like, well, they might not get another anemone, and they're in short supply, so you have to bring them with you.
Wow.
Great. So
yeah.
funny.
It's like the really worst amazing. Blue tack ever when you're moving out of a house. Scraping
2 days.
Away.
Yeah.
Why did I put that poster up?
Have you heard of Aki Inomata? She's a Japanese artist.
No, I don't think so.
She does collaborations with animals. And one of the animals that she's done an art project with is a hermit crab.
Okay.
So she's 3D printed miniature cities.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
and she
then
turns and she puts the miniature city sort of model she's built in on top of a shell. And then lets the hermit crab move into so that. Nice. It is cool.
Really?
I mean, I guess it's also not a natural shell, which would be the best thing. But it's an interesting, you know.
They will move into anything. Like, you give them, like, you can make them little Lego homes. They'll move. They'll try that.
And I looked a bit more into her work. Inomata, she's done another project, which is called I Wear the Dog's Hair and the Dog Wears My Hair.
Okay.
And she and her dog wore capes made from each other's hair.
Oh.
Okay.
And it looks a lot nicer than you would think it would look.
When you say collaboration, to me...
That was the dog's idea.
She said, I collected the hair of a dog called Cielo and my own hair over a number of years and then make clothes out of my hair for the dog and the dog's hair for myself so we could exchange coats. The two species, human beings and dogs, have developed together over the ages. This work examines the relationship between a human and her pet.
Okay.
What kind of dog was it? I just want to know what kind of patterning
it had. Small dog.
Oh, wow.
Was it spotty or stripy or...
Just brown, I think.
I'm just wondering if it's a small dog, what kind of outfit you can make, really.
It's wearing quite a natty little waistcoat. It looks good.
Nice.
And she's wearing a kind of cool sleeveless jacket thing.
So the dog's waistcoat is made out of her hair.
That's right.
So why don't we make more clothes out of human hair?
Yeah, Andy.
That's a good question.
Oh, I don't know.
Let's do it.
Well, one creepy, I would say.
Yeah. But I mean, you get a lot of... I mean, I guess they use... Like, when you get your hair cut, like, if it's good hair, they'll use it for making wigs. So
yeah,
that's important.
Yeah. Make wigs.
That's good.
That's true.
So maybe we do that instead. I don't know. I just wondered.
Probably. I mean, this woman's a very good artist, it sounds like. And probably most people who try to make clothes out of human hair would look like shit.
Yeah, and also just think of all the head and shoulders you have to put in the washing machine.
Do you guys know about... I really love historical manias, and I think we often cover them on the show, and I don't think we've talked about conchylomania or conchylomania.
Ooh, yeah.
In the 18th century, people just got really obsessed with collecting shells, didn't they?
They really did.
And it sounds like a really fun time to be alive, and... The
cons, you'll die at 40. Pros,
lovely shell collection.
Got some
nice shells.
Yeah.
Worth it. So I suppose, like a lot of these manias, it's a time when people in the Western world or in Europe are exploring more, so they're finding more exciting shells around the world. The most valued was this one called Glory of the Sea. Have you seen a Glory of the Sea shell?
Yes.
They're not that impressive, are they?
Well, no, you're not. You're right. I've seen one that was from that time, and it was collected by Victorian collectors in the Natural History Museum.
Oh, cool.
On the back. And but it's because no one had one. And so therefore, you know, the few that existed. Is that the one where there's a story about someone buying another one? He had one already, bought another one at auction, and then immediately smashed it to pieces.
In order to up the value of the first
I don't,
one.
Yeah. And that might just be apocryphal. I don't know if it's true, but it's that kind of level of
mania. It was that vibe.
Yeah.
There's definitely one that sold for 3 times more than a Vermeer painting at the same auction. And then there was this awful moment where we slightly got over the shell collecting obsession by the 20th century, but they were still really valuable. And I think in 1966, there were only 41 known specimens in the world.
Wow.
And then in 1969, we just found this habitat in New Guinea where they all live. And now there are tons of them.
Scuba divers found them, didn't they?
Yeah.
I think,
And that's probably not so many left for hermit crabs now.
No, that's true.
Actually, I don't know if they're good for hermit crabs. They've got quite a small opening.
They are very petite. It would have to be the very lower end of the housing market,
right.
I think.
First time.
Yeah. You've written a whole book about shells, haven't you?
I have.
Spirals in Time.
That's correct.
Such a great title.
Thank you.
Can I ask you, Helen, about periostracum?
I
might be saying it wrong.
I say periostracum, but you know, well, I'm making that up as
well. You're an actual expert in this field, so I'm going to get what you're saying. Is it true that shells, this is like a skin?
Yes.
Shells
yeah.
have skin
Some
in life.
Do, yeah. So it's like a hairy layer that grows on the outside. I think it's like a probably camouflage, probably some sort of protective thing that makes them look less like a shell and more like a bit of weedy rock.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. All the shells that we see, well, no, like lots of them, will have had skin. That's weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't that weird? I found it a bit weird.
It's quite weird, yeah. And then things like cowries, which are really shiny. You know, have you seen like big, lovely, shiny cowrie shells? The reason they're shiny is because part of their body called the mantle, which is like the pink bit on a mussel. When you eat mussels, that's the mantle. Anyway, it folds over the outside when they're alive. So they cover themselves in like a part of their body, which means they stay nice and shiny and they don't have like stuff growing on them. That's why they are so like porcelainy, kind of shiny, glassy.
Is it porcelana is the Italian for cowrie shell, I think.
Is it?
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. There so. You go. Yeah. So that's why they...
I think porcelain
so nice
was named after the cowrie shell, I think.
Ooh, that's cool.
And the cowrie shell was named porcelana because it reminded people of a pig's vagina.
Yeah, cowries have got a lot of that sort of stuff going on.
You can see that when you picture a cowrie shell. I mean, yeah. I can see
first thing that springs to mind.
If you've only ever seen a cowrie shell or a pig's vagina, basically you've seen them both.
I think that's correct. Mm. Yeah, I would say.
For people at home.
Is it true, Helen, that we don't really know how shells form when animals grow their own shells?
Like
the process of biomineralization?
Yeah, true.
It's a bit of a mystery.
It is still a bit of a mystery because it's one of those things that takes a very long time. I think there's a lot going on. There's like a protein scaffold that gets laid down first, I think, and then the calcium carbonate, which is the hard stuff, gets laid down in that. Mm-hmm. And it's all at the outer edge of it.
They harvest the calcium ions and carbonate ions from seawater and then combine the two of them together and they make crystals of calcium carbonate, which then go on this... scaffold.
Right.
It sounds like we do know how it's made.
Yeah.
Okay, but... Okay.
I mean, that's... brush.
We know what happens, but...
Right. How?
And also why...
exactly. And then it can be...
But I just think that's insane that they can harvest...
But they don't know that they're doing it. It's not like they're chemists.
It doesn't make it less impressive. Well, it does make it a bit less impressive, but I do think it's still just amazing.
It's really cool.
The world's most exclusive textile is made from a bivalve. I'd never heard of this. Have you seen this?
Mm-hmm.
It's made from the pen shell.
So a bivalve is like a mussel, right? Or a...
Yeah, a thing with two
shells. A snappy
two shells.
Shell
the snappy
guy.
Shells,
a
yeah.
A Pac-Man.
Yeah.
There are only 60 items known to be made of this special silk from this special pen shell. And so you've seen one of these things. And basically, they're huge, aren't they, the shells? They're like a metre tall.
Yeah, I mean, they used to be. Now they're not. They're doing quite badly now and there's not as big. But yeah, it's basically like a beard. Oh, like when you have mussels, if you eat moule magnier and you pull off the mossy, beardy bits.
Yeah,
the same stuff.
The threads,
yes. Exactly.
And they use this hair to embed themselves in the seabed,
exactly.
Right? Little roots.
Yeah.
And then you make this amazing silk out of it.
Yeah, you go through it. It goes through stages of processing. I went to Sardinia, which is really where the only people left who do it.
Yes.
And
in fact, I think there's one woman left, I read. And it's did you meet one of them?
I met that one woman.
Chiara Vigo.
Yes.
Oh, wow, you've got opinions on Chiara Vigo.
I don't know if I should be mean. No, I'm not going to be mean, but she claims to be the last living mistress of sea silk, as it's called. But I met several other people who do it. And
this is explosive news to me and probably no one else.
No, and it's all in the book. It's in Spirals in Time. I talk about it. I met her and she's kind of all like very woo-woo about it, and she can go into her little workshop and she does all this kind of and here it is and I do all these things. But then I met two other women who've learned it from there, because it's like it's handed, it's no one does it because you're not allowed to harvest these things anymore, apart from the fact they're not doing very well because they've just been wiped out by a disease. Pen shells are now protected, so you can't go and take one to get there.
So did you call the police on this one?
Well, no, because she claims that she can sustainably harvest them, but no one's allowed to watch her do it. That was the part where I was like,
yes, because she says she doesn't harm the shells.
Yes,
no,
exactly.
Shells
she's like, no, they're fine, they grow back. And I'm like, they do grow back, but I don't know how fast and if it's fast enough. And she doesn't let anyone watch her while she's doing it.
How interesting.
I will keep the pig alive while I make this bacon sandwich, but I must do it in a closed room and you can't come in.
You might hear some squealing. That's me. I just love bacon so much.
Okay, that's it. That's all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. And if you want to get in touch with any of us, you can find these guys on some of their social medias. Andy, You're on
Twitter at Andrew Hunter M.
James?
My Instagram is no such thing as James Harkin.
Helen, do you have any online
I do. Twitter is Helen Scales and Insta it's Dr. Helen Scales because someone already had Helen Scales.
Dr. Helen Scales on Instagram. Mm-hmm. Or you can email podcast@qi.com or you can go to our Twitter account at no such thing or Instagram at no such thing as a fish or go to our website nosuchthingasafish.com where you'll find links to our brand new tour, which is selling out fast. So please get there because we have so much fun. We're going around the UK, Ireland, Australia, New Zealand. Do come see us in any of those places. Way more important than that is please buy all of Helen's books. They're amazing, but definitely buy the latest book, which is...
What the Wild Sea Can Be.
It's such a romantic title.
Do you like
I love it.
Yeah. I came up with it first. Normally the title comes last. Sparrows in Time was particularly painful. That was last minute. But this one I came up first, so yeah.
And it has optimism in it, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that's kind of the point. It's yes. Like, let's not give up. And there's lots of things that's hopeful. And hopefully there's some fun things in there too.
So do that and come back again next week to catch us again. We will see you then. Goodbye.
I'd never heard of that egg. I gotta look it up when
it's
I get home.
It's fucking good. Yeah, it's really good. Like I'm. It genuinely works.
At what temperature as well? Because that's the other thing.
Oh yeah. 150 Celsius. For 3 hours.
Yeah. Fine. Good. Just checking.